What we're going to do is we're just going to open up the book. We're going to read a story about a man who followed God. And I'm just going to point out some things that I think are key that we can learn from his life that we can try to apply to our own. And brothers and sisters, what I really hope we'll kind of get from this story as we look at the life of Elijah is we really need to ask ourselves, when we say that the Lord is our God, do we really mean that he is our God? And do you get what I mean by that? There's a difference between calling somebody something and actually treating them that way. About 10 months ago or so, we got a new boss at work. And two of my teammates just could not handle this new boss. They thought they were in charge. And so they would call them their boss, but they would tell him every idea he had was stupid. They would go above him and around him if they didn't like decisions that he made. They basically would do anything and everything possible to make his life hard and to not respect him in any possible way. In title, they called him boss, but in action, they didn't respect him at all as boss. Now, it took some time and things changed and they realized that they had to line up in a certain way. And I share that just simply for ourselves, going, a lot of us call God our God, but do we really mean that? Do we really treat him as that he is the Lord, the Almighty, that he is above us in every conceivable possible way, and that we submit ourselves each and every day to his direction, to his word, and to his wisdom? One of the scary things I'm seeing happen in Christianity, especially the evangelical circle, is this idea that God is actually there to help you make your plans happen. There's one of my favorite lines ever from our different presidents. A few of them have said it, but the one I recently heard was taped from Reagan, and he said, "I am more concerned now that we are on God's page than he is on ours." And I think as people, we kind of have to have that same conversation with ourselves. I think sometimes what happens is we have these own pictures in our mind of where we want to go, what goals we have, what we want to accomplish, what we want to do, and we lay those out and we hold on to them tightly and dearly. And what we pray for is not for God's will to be done, but that God helps us accomplish our will. And that's the wrong way to go about things. Even Jesus himself in John chapter 6, verse 38 said, "I have come not to do my will, but the will of him who sent me." Jesus, with all the power, all the might, all the mercy, anything and everything you could ever imagine in a human being, said, "I come not to do what I want. I come to do what he wants." And brothers and sisters, I honestly think this is the number one thing that you and I have got to learn in our lives and make the core of who we are, how we live, and what we do. Because when we truly let go of that, when we truly wake up in the morning and go, "Father, the goal today is to do what you want, nothing else," that's where we're going to experience the freedom and the mercy and the blessings and the grace that he talks about throughout the pages of this book. But as long as we keep holding on to our own goals, our own plans, our own way of doing things, we're going to have this continual battle, because what we're really trying to do is we're trying to fill the role of God in our own lives, and we're treating him like a genie in the bottle that can maybe help us get there. And so as we look today at 1 Kings chapter 17 and we look at the life of Elijah, I want you to truly see the submissiveness of this man, yet the amazing things that God does through him. Go with me to the Word. 1 Kings chapter 17, verse 1, it says, "Now Elijah the Tishbite of Tishbe in Gilead said to Ahab, 'As the Lord, the God of Israel, lives, before whom I stand, there shall be neither dew nor rain these years except by my word.'" Okay, so let's break this down real quick, because Elijah's story just kind of jumps right into it, okay? So what do we know about Elijah? Well, this is the first time his name ever shows up in the Bible, and we know that he's a Tishbite from Tishbe. Okay, so very descriptive there. That helps us a lot. Do you know what we know about Tishbe? Pretty much nothing. In fact, if you go throughout the historical records, it's one of those cities that's so small that it doesn't show up on the map. It's just one of those small, small places. In Texas, we have a million of those, right? Have you ever seen those? Right? You know, you're looking for the city, and like your GPS, you're like, "Oh, we just passed it." When? I didn't even know that we passed it. When did that happen? That's where this guy is from. He's a nobody from Nowheresville, okay? He has no history, no background, no nothing. We're introduced to him, and what's the first thing this guy does? He goes to Ahab, which it doesn't say here, but Ahab is the king. He goes to the king and he says, it's not going to rain. In fact, there won't even be dew on the ground until I say. Now, a couple things here, because there's two things we kind of miss in our modern society. One, rain's a big deal. What's actually kind of nice for us in Texas is we understand this because we're continually and constantly on water restrictions, right? Has anybody gotten in trouble for watering on the wrong day? Anybody done that one?
Yeah.
Did you guys know they actually have police officers who drive around and monitor if you're using water? My boss got taken to water court, and he was like, I didn't even know there was a water court. But yes, there's a water court. You water on the wrong day, and you're in trouble. Okay, let's be honest. We're at church. We're family. Who's the neighbor who calls on those people who water on the wrong day? Okay, we got one. Okay. You know there's one of us in here, right? Yeah? Oh, your address ends in a 4. You should be on a Thursday. Yeah? So water's a big deal back then because it ties into everything. It's the food. It's the economy. It's everything is built on crops. And as soon as crops dry up, your animals can't be fed, your economy falls, your people aren't healthy, everything's in trouble. So what I love about Elijah is, Elijah, day one, first entrance, walks into the king, the most powerful man in the country, possibly in the world, and goes, hey, your economy's gone, your power's gone, until I say. Now the reason I think this is so important is if God told you to do that, would you be scared? I mean, this guy's more powerful than the President of the United States. Would you want to walk into the President's office and just basically go, yeah, I'm more powerful than you? You're a sinner. You're not doing God's thing. So until I say, everything's coming down. That's a bold move. That's a courageous move. That's a crazy move. It's one of the things I love about being on this journey with God is God asks you to do stuff that sometimes just doesn't make sense. I mean, could you imagine Elijah like logicking this one out with his family? Yeah, so God, he wants me to go talk to Ahab, and I'm going to tell him that, yeah, it's not going to rain. Can you imagine what his family would have been like? Yeah, let's do the pro-con list on that one, right? All the cons would be towards doing this. There would only be one pro, and that's God said to do it. And what I love about Elijah, that's enough. He could have a million cons, one pro, and that's that God says it, and he goes, I'm going. What this scene kind of feels like to me is, have you ever watched one of those movies that starts in the middle? Right? You know, there's an action scene or something dramatic's happening, and it kicks off, and then it goes 3 days earlier, right? And it kind of leads you up. We kind of expect that to happen here. You think, like, he's just declared war on the king. This is about to get good. Now watch what God does. Because it's not what you expect. He goes in, he says this, and then in verse 2 it says, and the word of the Lord came to him, depart from here and turn eastward and hide yourself by the brook Cherith, which is east of the Jordan. You shall drink from a brook, and I have commanded the ravens to feed you there. So he went and did according to the word of the Lord. He went and lived by the brook Cherith that is east of the Jordan. And the ravens brought him bread and meat in the morning, and bread and meat in the evening, and he drank from the brook. And after a while, the brook dried up because there was no rain in the land. Okay, does anybody see something weird happening here? I mean, just put yourself in Elijah's shoes, right? God asks you to go call war on the most powerful person in the country, right? You do that, and then the next thing he tells you is, go hide. Is that what you would expect to be the next line, right? You're kind of thinking, wait a minute, hide? I kind of thought you had my back here. I thought we were going to do this. I thought we were going to war. I thought we were going to make something happen. No, he tells him, go declare war and then go hide. And how deep in hiding do I want you? Don't even go to the town for food. You're going to drink from the brook, and I'm going to have birds fly you in food each day. That's how this is going to happen. Now, I want to share something here that I find funny. I've read a lot of commentaries about this passage. And what most commentaries tend to say of what's happening here is that God is teaching Elijah to rely on him. They say this man is learning that God's going to provide for you. And I absolutely think that's possible. But let's just rewind a second here. How did we meet Elijah? He walked into the king's palace and told him, I'm going to war with you. knowing in that very moment he's putting his life, his family's life, everybody that he knows life at risk. Does this sound like a man who needs a lesson in faith in God? Does this sound like a man who needs a lesson in obedience? I don't personally think so. I kind of think he's already doing pretty good at that. So why does this happen? Why does God declare war through Elijah and then immediately hide this guy? You know what the answer is? I don't know. Nobody knows. See, there's an important thing that we're going to see throughout Elijah's life, and it's an important lesson for you and for me. That is, stop having expectations of where things are going to go. See, brothers and sisters, we get so concerned when God gives us commands about what's going to happen after those commands that we build up this world for ourselves of what we expect to happen. And the problem is when we build these expectations, we really go into panic mode when they're not met. Yeah, I've kind of shared this before. Have you ever done this one to yourself where you think a restaurant's going to be terrible and you go and it's actually mediocre, but you end up leaving going, wow, that was really good. And it was because you walked in thinking it was going to be disastrous, but when it turned out to be okay, you were like, eh, that was pretty good. Or have you ever done vice versa? You've heard about a place over and over and over and over again, or maybe it's a movie and it's the best movie ever, and then you go and watch it and it's like, eh. And you actually end up leaving the place going, eh, I didn't like that. I thought it was going to be amazing, but it was just right here. Our expectations have so much to do with how we emotionally respond to things. And where you and I are dangerous animals is we want to predict the future. We want to hear God say this and then imagine what that's going to lead to. And what we have to be careful is God sees things from a different view than you and me. Trying to box him in, trying to restrain him, trying to put him into the picture you build is just a foolish thing to do. If you want to follow with me, you can. If not, just hold that place. Flip over to Job 38. The book of Job is one of my favorites about this whole idea of expectations. Job's bought into what you and I have bought into, which is this concept that if I'm a good person, God's going to do good things for me. If I'm a good person, if I pray, if I go to church, if I give to the needy, if I do the right things, then that means my life should be blessed. And typically when we say blessed, what we're really talking about is not what's happening here. We're talking about materialistic things. We're talking about how are we perceived by the world, how much money is in my bank account, what kind of car do I drive, what's my health look like. Those are the things we typically think about when we talk about being blessed. Well, the whole book of Job, Job's having terrible things happen. And he's going, why? And he keeps making this one argument. He says, if I could just sit face to face with God and explain to him what's happening here, he would realize there's a mistake. I want you to think about that arrogance for just a second, right? That's where, again, that mentality I'm telling you about, do you really perceive God as your God? Job thinks that there's some kind of cosmic mistake that he's at the center of, and if he could just have this face-to-face with God, God could go, oh my gosh, I'm so sorry. I don't know how this happened. We must have got something mixed up upstairs, and you're right, you're supposed to have more blessings than this. But I want you to see how God responds after 37 chapters of Job talking through his problems. In Job chapter 38, it says, then the Lord answered Job out of the whirlwind. Now, first off, if you get your face-to-face conversation with God, do you want it to start with him coming down in a whirlwind? Probably not, right? Probably not. I want you to listen to his words. He says, who is this that darkens counsel by words without knowledge? Dress for action like a man. I will question you, and you will make it known to me. So what is God's kind of remarks here? You wanted to talk? Let's talk. Get ready, stand like a man, and be ready for what's about to come to you. And what I want you to see, because we don't have time to read it all, but let's just start with the questioning that happens. Where were you when I laid the foundations of the earth? Tell me if you have understanding. Who determined its measurement? Surely you know. Or who stretched the line upon it? Or what were its bases sunk? Or who laid its cornerstone when the morning stars sang together and all the sons of God shouted for joy? Or who shut the sea in with doors when it burst out from the womb? When I made clouds its garments and thick darkness its swaddling band? What is God doing here? He's reminding Job of, Job, where do you know where you stand, Job? You're sitting here looking at the last 2 months of things that have happened, and you're going, oh, this doesn't make any sense. Surely something's wrong. And God's reminding him, Job, do you know who you're talking to? Job, I literally know every single grain of sand on this earth. I know every hair on your head. I know every part of this galaxy. I know the exact measurements of this world. Why? Because I made it. I know everything there is to know. This is like a kindergartner who doesn't know his ABCs telling you that your paragraph has a run-on sentence. It doesn't make any sense. And he goes on with these questionings to remind Job, Job, I'm God. I'm God. See, brothers and sisters, one thing that's happened in our society which is very dangerous, and it's kind of this hard, delicate balance. If you would take us back to 1940s, 50s, 60s, you would see sermons preached about God that, man, it was a scary God. It was fire and brimstone. It was about how if you're a sinner, God is going to burn you in hell, and God is going to come down with his wrath and his judgment, and he will have justice. And we focused all on this part of God that was scary. And so a lot of people came to church not because they loved God, but because they were terrified of what he would do to them. Now, I want to be clear. That stuff does exist. He is a God of justice. And one day his wrath will pour out on his world for all the sin that has occurred and for all those who stand against him. But that's just one part of him. There's another beautiful part of him where he is the most compassionate, graceful, merciful, loving being that this world has ever known. Now, what's happened in our modern society is that's all we focus on. So we turn God into this, from this old angry man into this loving big teddy bear. And what we believe today is I can do anything I want. I can commit any sin over and over and over again. And I can just go, hey, God's going to love me. No big deal. We struggle so badly as a people to get it right. To be there in the middle where we understand, yes, there's love. Yes, there's justice. Both these things are who God is. And what God is reminding Job is, I'm God. I see things from a different place than you. So Job, I need you less concerned about what's going to happen and more concerned with what I'm asking you to do right now. So jump back to Elijah. Why is he at this brook? Who knows? If you'd ask Elijah why you're at that brook, he'd give you a simple answer. Because God told me to be here. Because God told me to be here. What's amazing to me is, can you imagine how Elijah's life is a lot simpler and less stressful than ours? Right? You know, we think about what God says us, and then we think of all the ramifications of that, and we get stressed out by these possibilities that may never happen. Elijah just simply goes, hey, God told me to go over here, so I'm going over there. Well, what will I happen? I don't really care. I just know he wants me over there, so I'm going over there. Elijah truly treats God like he's God. He is the master and Elijah is the servant. And he's fine with that. Now look what happens next. Verse 8. It says, then the word of the Lord came to him, arise, go to Zarephath, which belongs to Sidon, and dwell there. Behold, I have commanded a widow there to feed you. So he rose and went to Zarephath. And when he came to the gate of the city, behold, a widow was there gathering sticks. And he called to her and said, bring me a little water in a vessel that I may drink. And as she was going to bring it, he called to her and said, bring me a morsel of bread in your hand. And she said, as the Lord your God lives, I have nothing baked, only a handful of flour in a jar and a little oil in a jug. And now I'm gathering a couple of sticks that I may go in and prepare it for myself and my son, that we may eat it and die. And then Elijah said to her, do not fear. Go and do as you have said, but first make a little cake of it and bring it to me, and afterward make something for yourself and your son. For thus says the Lord, the God of Israel, the jar of flour shall not be spent, and the jug of oil shall not be empty, until the day that the Lord sends rain upon this earth. And she went and did as Elijah said. And she and he and her household ate for many days. The jar of flour was not spent, neither did the jug of oil become empty, according to the word of the Lord that he spoke by Elijah. My brothers and sisters, what I always kind of get from this is, is Elijah a man of power? I'd say yes. I don't know about you guys. I can't do that. Wouldn't that be a nice little trick to be able to do? Go to the pantry and just, hey, that bag of Oreos will never run out. You just keep pulling Oreos and they're just going to keep refilling, right? That'd be a nice trick to do, right? Especially towards the end of the month when the paycheck's getting low, right? Just keep on eating. Where I want us to pause and just think for a second, this is purely speculation, but have you ever been in a place like this with Elijah where you feel like your talents are being wasted? And I wonder, did Elijah ever wake up in the morning and realize, like, here I am, this prophet of God that has been given unbelievable amounts of power, and what am I doing with my days? I'm hanging out with a widow and her son, making sure her flour doesn't run out. There's people dying, there's people in famine, our country's falling to pieces, all these things are happening around me, and what am I doing? I'm taking care of a widow and her son. I don't know about you, but I've been there. I've been there or thought I was there, and I thought I had bigger things planned for me. And I got frustrated because I was waiting for God to do something in my life, and the whole time missing that maybe He already was. Maybe He already was. I was listening to a sermon from one of my favorite pastors, Matt Chandler, and he was talking about how he can't wait to get to heaven. Because we know that for each of us that are Christians, for each of us that call Jesus Christ Lord, that there are heavenly treasures that we earn. Treasures that come not from being at church on Sunday or from, you know, praying a beautiful prayer at the pulpit, but treasures that come from living a life that's submitted to God, from living a life that truly shows love for our neighbors, for living a life where we sacrifice ourselves for others. And he said he can't wait to get there because we're going to learn who all the real heroes are that we never saw on this earth. He's going to be like, we're going to get up there and, you know, the richest people are going to be some of the people that nobody ever noticed. Because, well, nobody ever shined a spotlight on them and nobody ever really recognized them for their talents and their abilities. Once we get up there, what we're going to realize, there were these people that just lived their lives for everyone else. And while the world missed it, he didn't. And he said, how cool is it going to be one day to imagine us being there and seeing these folks who've been missed their whole lives just sitting there with all these heavenly treasures, finally being acknowledged for the love and the lives that they've lived. See, brothers and sisters, the thing I kind of want us to get from this part of Elijah's journey is you're not the judge of whether what you're doing is big or small. God is. God is. And so you may look at where you're at in life right now and go, you know what, this doesn't match up to the dream I had. You know, this doesn't match up to the vision I had. This isn't maximizing the talents and abilities that I have. Guess what? None of that matters. None of that matters. All that matters is, are you where God wants you to be? Because the reality of the situation is, we don't really know what will happen with our work. We don't really know what the fruits will be. The fruits are our job. What the fruits are will be determined by Him and Him alone. Our part of the work, our part of the journey is just simply to go and plant the seeds that He asks us to plant. And brothers and sisters, if you go throughout the Bible, you will see journeys of men who make unbelievable steps with God. They fight fights with God. They do amazing things with God. And it never turns out quite the way that you expect. But what we end up seeing in these people's lives is, that's okay. That's okay. Let me give you a great example of this, because I really want you to understand this. Now flip with me to Deuteronomy chapter 34. In Deuteronomy 34, we talk about the end of the life of one of the most unbelievable leaders in all the Bible, the life of Moses. Verse 34, chapter 34, verse 1, it says, then Moses went up from the plains of Moab to Mount Nebo, to the top of Pisgah, which is opposite Jericho. And the Lord showed him all the land, Gilead, as far as Dan, all of Naphtali, the land of Ephraim and Manasseh, all the land of Judah, as far as the western sea, the Negeb and the plain that is the valley of Jericho, the city of palm trees, as far as Zoar. And the Lord said to him, this is the land which I swore to Abraham, to Isaac, and to Jacob, I will give it to your offspring. I have let you see it with your eyes, but you shall not go over there. So Moses, the servant of the Lord, died there in the land of Moab, according to the word of the Lord. And he buried him in the valley of the land of Moab, opposite Beth-Bor. But no one knows the place of the burial to this day. Moses was 120 years old when he died. His eye was undimmed and his vigor unabated. And the people of Israel wept for Moses in the plains of Moab for 30 days. Just to remind you, Moses' whole goal, his whole focus of his ministry, was to take God's people, Israel, out of Egypt, where they were slaves, and bring them to the Promised Land. That was the whole goal. He spent 40 years in the desert with these people, trying to get them to the Promised Land. You would think, after all those battles, after all those fights, that Moses would actually get to set foot in the Promised Land. He doesn't. He doesn't. The closest he gets is this last moment. He's on top of a mountain with God, and God shows him the entire land. And he says, basically, we're here. They'll never set foot in it, but it will be for your offspring. You've got them here. Now, there's two ways to look at this. The earthly way is what? What would the world say about Moses? Your goal was to get your people out of Egypt through the desert to the Promised Land. Did you ever set foot in the Promised Land? No. I don't know about you guys, but if that was me at work and that was my evaluation, I can tell you what would follow next. And it would be that you're a colossal failure, you didn't accomplish the task, and you're a loser. Now, they don't say them in those words, but typically, you know, the political speech they give to say those kind of things to you. The world would look at Moses and go, you didn't accomplish your goal, you lose. But brothers and sisters, if this is how losing looks, I'm all for it. Do you realize what happens here? Do you realize the intimacy of this moment between Moses and God? Moses doesn't die because he's old. It tells us his eyes had not dimmed and the vigor had not left his body. Moses goes home because God goes, it's time to go home. And the beautiful thing I love is God has this relationship with Moses that's so intimate, so pure, so they're just in sync. That who buries Moses? God does. And who knows where he's buried? Only God. That's the victory. The victory is not the results. The victory is not getting into the Promised Land. The victory is not defeating the evil king. The victory is not changing the world. The victory is being with him. That's the fight. That's what we're aiming for each and every day. And that's the beauty of this relationship. See, brothers and sisters, the rest of the things we do in this world, we can absolutely fail at. I wake up every day and I hope, I pray that I can be the best pastor, that I can give good sermons, that I can lead this church in the right way. But you know what? The world can take that from me. Easy. The title I have can be stripped away in a blink of an eye. Most of the things we hold on to this in this world can be ripped from us so cruelly, so quickly. You know what the one thing is nobody can ever rip from me? God. Try. Do your best. You can't touch him because he won't let you. See, that's the beauty of this relationship. When we pour ourselves into being with God, we pour ourselves into a thing that can't be touched by anything. It'll never decay. It'll never mold. It'll never be stolen. It'll never be stripped away. It'll never be any of those things that we fear in life. It will just be this beautiful thing that's always there for us. Always there. Brothers and sisters, what I want you to see here, what I want you to see happening in Elijah in this early part of his life, is that this man in his day-to-day life has made one thing his focus, and that's I go where God asks me. That's it. I go where he asks me. That's my only focus. I think, brothers and sisters, we could learn a lot from that. I think we could learn a lot from waking up each day and not having this picture of a dream that we had 10 years ago. not having this 5-year plan, not having any of those things, but just simply waking up and going, God, where do you want me today, Lord? Now, I don't know about you, but if 10-year-old you could meet you right now, would 10-year-old you have some questions? Like 10-year-old Luke would be like, first, who ate me? And what happened to your hair, man? I think the second one would be like, Pastor, really? What happened to Navy SEAL and NBA? Because that's where we were going, man. That was the dream. You're a pastor? Come on. 10-year-old me would have like a million questions because nothing that I would describe to him about my life, except for a handful of things, would look like what he pictured were going to happen one day. But you know what? I would tell 10-year-old me, dude, let those dreams go. This is far better than being an NBA player. This is far better than being a Navy SEAL. Those silly little dreams that you have will fade away and you will find where God wants you. And it's so much better. That needs to be our focus. Not to make the picture happen, but to just be with Him. My favorite story in probably New Testament happens when Jesus walks on water. Jesus comes out to the boat, you're walking on the water, freaks out the disciples. They think they're seeing a ghost, they don't know what's going on. Finally, they realize it's Jesus, and Peter looks out at him and says, Father, if you want me to come to you, I will. And Jesus tells him, come to me, Peter. And Peter, the only other man besides Jesus, walks on water, walking towards his Father, his focus completely and utterly on Him. It's not until Peter stops looking at Christ and starts paying attention to the stormy weather, to the fact that he's walking on water, the waves that are around him, it's not until that moment where he loses focus of Christ that he starts to sink. And brothers and sisters, that's us. That's you and me. If we'll walk out these doors and we will just lock eyes with Him and we'll go, Father, I'm coming. You will do things you never thought you could do. You will walk on your water. But if you instead look at everything else around you, you will miss the most beautiful things that are right there in front of you. Don't lose sight of Christ. Don't lose sight of your God. And I promise you, if you'll just submit yourself to Him, He's going to lift off your shoulders the weight that you've been trying to carry by yourself. He's going to take that stress from you. He's going to clear your vision. And He's going to give you a peace you just can't put a price on. Now, brothers and sisters, next week, and who knows, maybe 2 weeks. I thought I'd get through more this morning than I did, but we will continue to look at the life of Elijah. Because he's not a perfect man. But he's a man who has that one desire that I think you and I should be aiming at more and more. So feel free, you can read ahead if you want to ruin it for yourself. Spoiler alert, right? But we will continue in the next couple weeks looking at his life and seeing what it is that God can do with someone who submits themselves wholly. Let us pray.